Hello, this is Terrence McNally. As the Democratic candidate debates begin, let's listen to my March 2018 conversation with Harley Hochschild. In her book, Strangers in Their Own Land, based on 5 years' research in southern Louisiana, she asks why residents of the nation's second poorest state vote for candidates who resist federal help. Why, when corporations devastate their lives and their land, do they most hate the government? Listen to get a sense of what we're up against in 2020.
After hosting and producing the show for nearly two decades, in 2014, I stepped away from new live interviews, and the show continued on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn, streaming relevant interviews from the archives. And podcasts are available anytime, anywhere on iTunes, Podomatic.com, and at my site, TerrenceMcNally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same site. But with the election of Donald Trump, I have not been able to resist exploring the path forward in new interviews, and this is the 25th such interview. They include Paul Hawken on climate change, Naomi Klein on her book No Is Not Enough, David K. Johnston on the daily dirty work of the Trump administration, and they are all available on my website and at iTunes. And let me also, just before I jump into the interview, offer you a few websites for information on how to participate politically during this time. Both resisting Trump, the Trump administration, and moving toward the healthy and just future that we all need. Indivisible Guide, one word, indivisibleguide.com. That's a national kind of umbrella with about 5,000 local organizations. OurRevolution.com, Our Revolution, one word, that grew out of the Bernie Sanders campaign. MoveOn.org, longtime digital activists. Now working more closely lately with on-the-ground activists, and Courage Campaign, one word, couragecampaign.org, similar to Move On, but focused on California. And two very specific ones, Five Calls, that's the number five, and the word calls.org, which tells you the relevant and timely phone calls you might want to make to your representatives. And townhallproject.com tells you when your local representatives might be holding town halls near you, so you can go attend and let your voice be heard. Now to today's guest. Soon after the 2016 election, I discovered this quote from Antoine de Saint-Exupéry, who's most famous for writing The Little Prince. Here's the quote. If you want to build a ship, don't drum up the men to gather wood, divide the work, and give orders. Instead, teach them to yearn for the vast and endless sea. And my question is, how do we do that in 2018? And that day, a bit over a year ago, I wrote the following. Passion to return to a simpler past drove enough voters to the polls in swing states to decide the 2016 presidential election. How can we engage their emotions in a more positive, forward-looking, or progressive direction? When you offer people the preservation of the present or the return to the past, when you offer to postpone or eliminate change, as Trump does, your audience has an experience to draw from. And for many, an inflated or idealized vision of the past has a clear advantage over the yet-to-be-experienced future, the uncertainty of that future. Can we generate a vision of a future that is as welcome, compelling, inviting, and real as the past some so fondly remember? Let's start with the following questions. What is a compelling narrative that can drive Americans to yearn for a future richer than the past they want to come back? And what vision could we offer to engage their emotions, because clearly emotions are at play here, that will fuel their yearning rather than feed their fear? And who can do this, and who should do this, and who is doing this? And ever since that day, I've been wanting to talk with today's guest, Harley Hochschild, a professor emerita of sociology, as I said, at the University of California, Berkeley. For over 30 years, her inventive and provocative and useful insights about contemporary work and family have grown out of research. She's done the interviews, she's spent time with the people, and she has long focused on the human emotions which underlie our moral beliefs, practices, and social lives. She's known as the founder of the sociology of emotion. She's the author of several books, including Second Shift, The Time Bind, and The Outsourced Self. And at the core of her most recent book, Strangers in Their Own Land, is the power of a deep story. After 5 years talking with folks in southern Louisiana, Hochschild sensed that a particular deep story they share is what holds their political contradictions together. And I want to hear more about the power of that narrative and ask what she thinks is possible in terms of coming up with another narrative, a narrative that offers an inviting and inclusive future. And I imagine she will say, start by listening. Welcome, Arlie Hochschild, to Freeforum, a world that just might work. Let me tell listeners, we're recording this conversation on Tuesday, March 13th, 2018. So, I mean, you said just, you laughed and said as I began to say the time and date that, in fact, that would be your first advice, wouldn't it?
I think it would. I think it would. And to not be frightened, to sit down and respectfully listen to people that you know going in are going to be different from you in their outlook, their premises. But to pick up what you just said of the challenge you just posed of what it would be like to after you've listened, what kind of a vision of the could one put forward? You know, the people I came to know in researching strangers in their own land over 5 years in center of the petrochemical industry in Louisiana, very right wing. Everybody went for Trump. I got the feeling that they would be very interested in a vision which, for one thing, is unifying, you know, where mm-hmm. we're all together.
Mm-hmm.
And this, when I first got there and had to say, hi, I'm a sociologist at UC Berkeley, they'd say, oh, Berkeley, disunifying. And I'd say, but actually, you know, I live in a bubble, and I think we all us Americans live in bubbles, and they're very different, the coastal bubble and the inland bubble, the north from the south, and I've come to really learn about you. And because I'm worried about the divide. And then I would see a nodding head. They'd say, yeah, we're worried about this divide too. And we're also feeling that people on your side look down on people on our side. I said, well, tell me about that. You know, how do you feel that? What do you think people think? So it would begin with unity, this vision, this new vision. I also think a new vision could appeal to the idea of desire for adventure and fortitude, a kind of an idea of a new frontier that we are all facing it bravely, and we need to do this together, and the government should, you know, have a role in helping us as frontiers people. So instead of the great yesterday, as Richard Kapuscinski, the Polish journalist, famously said, you know, that all tyrants kind of will point to the great yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
And we are, in fact, facing a president who speaks to the great yesterday. He looks at the social codes of race and gender of yesterday. He looks at sources of energy, coal and oil of yesterday. He looks at jobs of yesterday, you know, big manufacturing jobs. And he's not really preparing us for the future. And so instead of the great yesterday, there's the great tomorrow. And so we're unified, you could say, in being frontiersmen, in facing the great tomorrow. And that would be getting people computer literate, getting a new army of computer coders, and new training to go on. Actually, the French president, Macron, has said in a recent speech at the World Economic Forum in Davos that he was going to institute lifelong learning for all French citizens. So you could be a 45-year-old mechanic, but you want to be a computer programmer. So you can go back to school, and the government will pay for it, to learn a new trade. And so the frontier of the future is going to require lifelong learning and capacity to switch gears and be socially supported as you learn new skills, and to have really state-of-the-art patient teachers and team building. I mean, I think what we could build up is an image of this new frontier as invitational and as calling for the best moral qualities we have. What I think is happening is that people are looking backward because they're afraid of looking forward. And what they're looking forward to are self-driving trucks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what's going to happen to those unemployed truck drivers?
Millions and millions. It's a huge industry.
Right, right. And actually, oil rigs that used to take, 20 people on a rig in the Gulf of Mexico, they're automating them. Now it'll be down to 5. So even in the industries that tend to attract kind of Trump loyalists, you know, they're facing automation and they know it. This isn't a surprise, but it's terribly frightening when you don't reconceive of it as a frontier that we're preparing for as a country as a whole.
Yeah, no, I'll tell you what, that's a few things happened as you were saying that. One, of course, when you say new frontier, one can't help but think of John Kennedy. And that was a shift of generations from Eisenhower, much his senior, middle of the country, Kansas, military, and post-World War II to that shift to young Catholic Kennedy. And I think that that there was, you know, we don't feel it now, but you and I both were present at the time. There was fear and resistance to this change and to this shift, and some would, I'm sure, on the side of that were afraid of what the 60s were bringing in with John Kennedy would say, see what happened? We were right. Mm-hmm. The 60s were scary. There was too much change. But I think that the idea of looking at the future as a new frontier harkens, what it does is it places the future in a tapestry that includes a great past for America. We have done very well by frontiers.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
You tap into traditional American history, traditional American qualities, and so on. Mm-hmm. And the government, I think one could make the case that the government has done a good job of helping us in those previous frontiers,
right.
Whether
right.
it was the, you know, getting the railroads built or the interstate highway system, you know, just very simple things. The public mm-hmm. school system, the land grant college system, the government has
right.
helped us in those previous frontiers. And I'm thinking, obviously, to my mind, the Clinton campaign did not do
no.
this image. But in a way, what I was asking as you were speaking was, does Bernie Sanders? And to some extent, I think he can't quite get there because his focus is so much on righting the wrongs he sees that are going on right now.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
In other words,
I think that's right. Actually, in my 5 years of research for strangers in their own land, I saw quite a few nods to Bernie Sanders. You know, people would say, oh, Uncle Bernie.
Yeah.
They'd say, you know, he's a socialist. We're a capitalist society. You know, he wants free education for everyone. Well, we can't afford that too much. Comes from somewhere, that money. So there would be dismissal, but then a kind of a friendliness. that he too sees something quite basic wrong. And returning to your question of a vision that would work, I think the vision that would work would have to acknowledge that we have been going down the wrong path, that in some regards, and that you can't just let factories go out of business and leave whole rust cities and degrade the life of farmers and let blue-collar salaries sink so that people are working two and three jobs. You can't just do that and not say, hey, we've got real problems. You know, we've got to fix them. We've been going down. I think Trump was right to kind of acknowledge the bad news, and that Hillary was wrong to say, well, just a few fixes here and there,
but we're
basically doing fine. People didn't relate to that.
Now, I don't know how many of the folks you were talking to watched the last debate, but what struck me was at that point, and it was at that point, it was looking like she was favored and so on, but I watched Trump basically say one thing over and over again in the last debate, which was, she's been there for 30 years. Look at how things are going. It's not going to be any different. And no matter what she said, that seemed to me to, if you will, trump everything.
That's right. And
I think you are absolutely right that what one needed, we're gonna circle back and get more into the stories that you learned and the stories you heard and so on in your research and so on to flesh out what we're talking about. But we've jumped into this question, so I'm going to keep with it, which is that one of the paradoxes that you're trying to answer is, why do people who need the federal government so much because of the pollution they face and the loss of jobs they face and all of those things, why are they so anti-government? And what you say is that when clearly several of the characters in your book have, it's very clear who the guilty party is that created that sinkhole or that destroyed that bayou, and it's private corporations. But what they see, which is the same thing I see, is that the government has been bought by those corporations.
Right. It isn't. That's exactly right. And they feel, the people I came to know, who became Trump supporters, felt about state government that it was corrupt, and it had taken on, in fact, the moral dirty work of the companies. But when I would ask them, why aren't you mad at the companies? Why are you mad at the government? They'd say, well, our tax dollars support the salaries of the people in the government, state government, Louisiana government, that is giving out permission slips to pollute public waters with toxic waste. And why should we pay that money to them? That's why we hate the government more than we hate the companies.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. It's that I have no control, or I feel I have no control over those private companies, but I have a little control over the government. And as you say, yes, if my tax money is the only thing that I might get out of this, that I realize that, you know, the game is being played on a field I'm not even on, if my tax dollars, those few tax dollars I'm going to get back, at least give me those. And so it's quite interesting, because I, as I said, and I believe you too, probably feel the analysis is the same. That when I and I've read your writings, when we fault the Democratic Party, it's because they have become beholden to the same funders as the Republicans. Only they make the case that they are different. They make the case that they are the force against those private corporations or against Wall Street, our protection. And in fact, we see, and these folks down there see, it's not so much the case.
Right, right. So there's a possibility for alliance.
Yeah.
That Indivisible, you know, needs to go for. Hey, we both don't want bought governments.
Yeah.
We want governments who are servants to protect the people, and we want good government. And, you know, the longer I talked with people and in a kind of trusting, open way, the more they weren't against government per se. They were against corrupt government.
The same thing I'm against. Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
And you point
out. A lot of common. And, you know, there are a lot of people who, I think it's one out of four people have voted for Trump would have voted for Bernie Sanders if he had,
yeah,
in the primary, if he had been the Democratic candidate. Well, now that's a group we ought to we ought to be talking to each other.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think
about this new narrative.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And I think Bernie, to his credit, is not to rehash. In other words, I want to get deeper into the future and into these people, and not rehash the election. But I often felt that if you looked around at a certain point during that campaign and saw that there were two candidates who were drawing crowds of 25,000. You'd think, well, those probably should be the two candidates.
Right, I know.
And it played out that way on the Republican side, but not on the Democratic side.
That's right.
When it comes down to it, passion, going again to, you know, all of your work, where emotion is a critical player in all of this, whatever we may think about social groupings and, you know, demographics and all of that, that passion is what gets people to the polls. It's what gets them to get their friends to the polls. And one side had it and the other side did not. One thought I had, again, this is what I thought we'd get to at the very end of the conversation, was this one. As I was driving to the studio today, I'd prepared the interview and everything, and suddenly this thought came to me that we know that Trump's victory was very narrow, that it basically was three Rust Belt states, 110,000 voters spread over those three states and so on because of the Electoral College. Perhaps there was, the Russian interference and the fake news made a difference, so on. It was a close election. But what one thing that's interesting is that without Trump's victory, had he not, whatever the circumstances were that pushed those three Rust Belt states into his column, had he not, without Trump's victory, we would still have had these ruptures in our culture. We would still have had the need to heal this. We would still have had the need for this new narrative, and not just a narrative. And I hope that people understand when you and I are saying that, we're not just saying an advertising message. We're saying that you actually live that narrative, that you mean it,
right.
It's not just messaging, but it's actually, we are going to do something about it. But had he not won, your book would have gotten very different, and Vance's book would have gotten very different receptions, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And this need that you're citing, and that I absolutely agree with, of healing these rifts and getting people who need what a good government can bring them to not hate it because it's been sullied, that would still exist.
That's right. And actually, if Hillary had won, I think what you're saying is we'd still be stuck with this great division.
Yeah.
And so actually, I think both Hillbilly Elegy and Strangers would still be relevant because they're focused, on this rift.
Yeah, but I'm saying people wouldn't have paid as much attention to them.
Maybe not.
Without getting the slap in the face. In other words, still his populist rise would have, obviously we know that, had she won, you'd still say, but my God, how did Trump get so many votes? And you'd look at your two books as one of the ways to talk about that.
Right.
But
why are so many people dead set against her? And I think why is she being so heavily criticized and unable to rule?
Yeah, yeah, it would. But I'm not saying I'm glad. Yeah, I'm not saying I'm glad about his victory, but I'm saying that the problems were there. He is a symptom. He is not the cause.
I think that's very wise. I really agree with that. I think that's an excellent point. And people are increasingly voting their social class and their region, I think, more than before. So that you're not, when you say I'm voting Republican, and their gender. So race, class, gender, and region. So when we talk about healing the divide, we need to get people together who have come from different regions, classes, genders, and races, and talk about this new narrative of a new frontier, a unifying a kind of narrative. How would it actually work out in reality? How do we want it to work out? So we would need to get agreement across these differences that express themselves as party differences, but underneath are differences of this other sort. I wanted to make another point about the perception of government. What's going to be the role of government in this new frontier? You know, mm-hmm. I suppose we're looking ahead.
Yeah.
We don't want, you know, the great yesterday. We want the great tomorrow as a unified country. Let's say, you know, we had some leaders that really got behind this. How can we honestly make this work for real? We would have to encounter people's ideas about government as constraint. A lot of the people I came to know in writing Strangers felt, oh, regulations, we're regulated to death, you know, and these useless bureaucrats are coming and imposing regulations. And so what we want is freedom from those. That was a refrain. And it took two forms. One was, well, wait a minute, the government is not regulating the big guys. It's not regulating the big polluters of Lake Charles in Louisiana, let's say. It's not regulating Sasol or any of the, you know, or Monsanto, the big ones. It's regulating the little guy. You go out fishing, and if you didn't have renewed your fishing license, well, he's going to fine you. So that is one kind of thing I heard.
Let me chime in something that I've noticed over the years, which I think plays right into this, which is that in the current situation, so I think that one of the top things that can bring people together is campaign finance reform and getting money out of politics. And I think that's one place Bernie, as you recall, always led with that. Whatever he ended up with, he always led with that. And I think that's something.
Right.
But here's the experience I've seen. I've worked a lot on environmental issues. And I'm just going to choose that as an example. If you are making some new landfill rules, what will happen is that Browning Ferris in waste management, the big players, will oppose them until they're inevitable. Once they're inevitable, they'll write them. And I think that is what goes on. So what happens is regulations get written to suit the biggest players. And set up. And by the way, that's what's going on with the current weakening of Dodd-Frank. Is that the regulation which was to handle the too big to fail banks ended up hurting some of the community banks, and now what you have is a law which is going to actually, you know, I think when you raise the limit to the limit that they're proposing, it will actually be, they may not be quite too big to fail, but they will be close. But it's that thing of, the regulations usually are hard for the small to medium business to accommodate,
right.
Never mind the individual fisherman.
Right, right. Excellent point. And you know, Bob Reich has written a book called Saving Capitalism.
Yep.
This is the former Secretary of Labor under Clinton, Robert Reich, and it's an excellent book because it points out that actually, you know, we don't have to be against capitalism. We're what the right is doing is conflating big capitalism with little capitalism.
That's right.
And that a lot of what's happening is actually going to be hard on and shut down small businesses.
Yep.
By empowering the big ones.
Yep.
So,
and
he looks into that book.
Made a similar point in Super Capitalism, a book from a few years ago, in which he said the golden age of this past that we look back to, while it wasn't golden for people of different races or different gender
right.
persuasions, perhaps. But what is considered that sort of golden age was a time when there were countervailing forces, when
right.
unions were strong
right.
and government was strong, and it was the dynamic tension between those that produced
right.
the ideal situation and you know, also produced the Powell memo, which ended up producing the power of the right, which has now weakened the countervailing
right.
force.
This is Terrence McNally. You're listening to my March 2018 conversation with Arlie Hochschild about her book, Strangers in Their Own Land, Anger and Mourning on the American Right.
So to go back to the new
narrative yeah.
that we need and what the new frontier would look like and how we could do it as a whole country and unify the country, it would be to pull forward some things from the recent past into the future, things we've lost, and that would be a balance and a system of checks and balances. In a sense, we used to have unions
mm-hmm.
And government watchdogs on counterbalancing big, powerful companies, and we have, as you say, lost that balance. So in envisioning a future, we need to envision checks and balances.
Yeah. You know, it's and I think what you're saying, interesting, is that when most people hear the term checks and balances, they think of civics and it being within
right.
government. But you're saying, no, checks and balances actually exist around government as well.
Right.
There are checks in our systems, which the unions were, which reform of campaign finance could be, and so on.
Right.
So that when and it's when you get those forces, and I think, you know, that it's a bit subtle, but I think it's something which there are so many metaphors for how things thrive when there is a balance of forces. It would be silly to say, but there are sports analogies. There is a reason that all of the major sports league have gone to try to come up with some sort of parity through the draft or through salary caps and things, so that there isn't just a few top teams that dominate everything.
Mm-hmm.
For a long time. I think that's a metaphor that a lot of folks can understand.
Right, right. I think that's right, especially when you think that most of the economic growth are the small startups
right.
and businesses.
Right.
So the new narrative should say, let's give them a chance.
Yeah.
And in order to give them a chance, we really need checks and balances to make make that the positives of that continue.
Yeah,
I want to circle back to an idea of what we can say to those who say, well, the government is just imposing terrible constraints on us. It's taking our freedom away.
Right. Let me just frame that again for listeners. What you're saying is that if government is perceived as a constrainer, And basically what you get from government is regulation and taxes, things that are being taken from you, either liberties or your money. How do you transform that to this notion that government is actually empowering you?
Potentially empowering and for the good and in service of citizens. I followed around in my research for Strangers in Their Own Land. I followed around a man named General Russell Honoré, who was the hero of the victims. He was the rescuer of the victims of
Katrina, right?
Katrina, right, in New Orleans, and four-star general, extraordinary person. And he's now become a big environmentalist and has started something called the Green Army in Louisiana. It's small. It's small because of the power of oil, and they're up against the power of oil. But they're a very brave band of people, and I've dedicated my book to them. The reason I followed him around is because I found him such an effective communicator. Now, I'll give you an example. I was in Lake Charles watching him give a talk to a bunch of businessmen, very, very conservative businessmen. And for them, the big symbol was freedom. Mm-hmm. We don't want constraints. We want freedom to grow our businesses, freedom to get rich, freedom from onerous government regulations, freedom, freedom, freedom. And so he's an environmentalist, and he's trying to get them interested in environmentalism, which they conceive of as a constraint on their freedom, okay? So he gets up, and he says, I woke up this morning, and I looked out at Lake Charles. I saw a man in a boat, and I saw that man had his fishing line out, and he had his bucket ready. But that man is not free to pull up an uncontaminated fish. And I thought to myself, I've just listened to a genius. What he has done is to take their symbol, and he doesn't oppose that symbol. He stretches it to a new situation they hadn't thought about. These men love to fish. They love to eat fish. You know, gumbo, jambalaya, they're big fish lovers, but they hadn't thought of freedom as the freedom to eat an uncontaminated fish. So he did what I came to call a symbol stretch. You take a person's symbol, you honor it, you just apply it to something they're not thinking about. Hey, the government could make me freer by regulating polluters.
That's right. That's right. Well, and there was a time probably before that pollution got in there when you were free to get that fish, and that uncontaminated fish, and then the freedom of the polluter to pollute took away your freedom, and now you need someone to help you get that freedom back.
Exactly.
No, I like that. Anything else from him? Because I think you're right. It's finding these people that are able to embody the new frontier and communicate it in a way. Remember the words I used, inviting, a compelling vision, an open and inclusive vision, rather than, you know, something which seems there isn't room for you.
You know, another way that I think we can employ this symbol stretching that I saw the general doing is to think about patriotism in a large way. The people I came to know over the 5 years of really getting to know them, visiting them, going fishing with them, and they all loved America, and they all felt extremely patriotic. You saw American flags on a lot of mailboxes. You saw them on clothing. You saw them on motorcycles and trucks, American flags. People felt very, very patriotic. And when I would ask people, well, what does that mean to you? I'll give you an example. One man said, I'd die for my country. I would lay down my life for my country. That's how much I love America. And that's a big thing. That's really important. And so what if you said, yes, I really honor your patriotism, and doesn't patriotism also apply to honoring the Constitution, a system of checks and balances, a free press, an independent judiciary, you know, a non-tyrannical kind of form of government? Isn't that what patriotism stands for? In other words, another symbol stretch. You take patriotism, but you say, hey, look, we're really worried about all this dissing of the New York Times and CBS and ABC and NBC, you know, the whole, that's not patriotic. So I think that's a huge, big symbol stretch we progressives need to make to reach out to Trump supporters and say, look, we're patriots too, and let's look at the real values that are emblematic of patriotism in our case.
Yeah, I mean, in other words, what was the revolution fought for, and what
right.
what was the vision that the founders fought for and handed to us? Let me
an independent press.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Huge piece
and
of it.
And a valued and honored independence.
Right.
That's right. So
and
that
one,
you don't
and
want
one that's,
just the press that agrees with you.
That's right. And one that's tricky is that whole separation of church and state. Is a core value of the founders that, you know, obviously has been lost and interpreted differently and so on. I wanted to jump on one thing you said. About this, when Benjamin Wallace Wells wrote in The New Yorker about your deep story,
mm-hmm.
he said, and I'm going to quote him, this story was that America, which was once characterized by hard work, was now characterized by cheating. The image that Hochschild chose was that of people cutting in line. Now, I, in reading your stuff, hadn't seen cheating, that particular concept. I saw the cutting in line, but I didn't see cheating. I myself, going back to the Bush-Cheney era, had thought that cheating would be a good way to characterize the behavior of Republicans and their wealthy donors, lying to invade Iraq, tricking people into signing for loans they couldn't afford, gerrymandering their districts, making it hard for people to vote, all of these sorts of things. And I thought, you know, cheating is something which most, you know, red-blooded Americans don't like. And would that have been a powerful, you know, a compelling way of sort of looking? We're Americans. We don't need to cheat to get ahead. We're inventive. We're hardworking and so on. And yet they cheat. Now, it is interesting that he at least found the cutting in line was the cheating. Any thoughts about that, the power of that particular concept?
For our listeners, maybe I should back up and say what a deep story is.
Definitely.
And how unfairness fits into it. One of the things I discovered and report in Strangers is that beneath everybody's politics, left and right, I think there is a deep story. But this is a book about the right's deep story. What is a deep story? A deep story is what feels true about an important, salient situation. You take facts out of the deep story. You take moral precepts out of the deep story. It's just what's left, what feels true about something salient. And in the right wing's deep story, you can tell it like a dream, sort of in metaphoric form.
Mm,
you're waiting
I see.
In line.
Yep.
And at the top of the hill is the American dream. And your feet are faced forward And the line hasn't moved in 2 decades. Actually, people I interviewed hadn't had a raise in 2 decades. And so they were retiring on less than they'd hoped to. And so in this Right Deep story, you're waiting in line for something you feel you really deserve. You have worked hard, you've obeyed by the rules, and in your mind, you don't begrudge anyone. You're a nice person. You go to church. And then, another moment of the Right Deep story, there are line cutters. Well, now, who are they? Well, by federal affirmative action guidelines, it would be blacks finally allowed access to jobs that have been historically reserved for whites, and even more threatening, women, half the population, finally being given access to jobs that have been historically reserved for men. And then they sought undocumented workers, a cutting in line. They even saw the oil-soaked brown pelican, Louisiana state bird, kind of waddle up and cut in line. And people said, oh, that the environmentalists put animals ahead of people. So they saw all of these as line cutters. And then they saw, in another moment of the right-wing deep story, the federal government waving at the line cutters. Oh, he's their president. He's forwarding their interests. And it's kind of a line cutter country then. And he's pushing me back. And as the right-winger is feeling pushed back, he's also feeling, look, what is there to be proud of? I can't be proud of my region. People are saying it's a backward region, the South, and wagging their moral finger at the South. And that it's a conservative region. They feel their values are not the values of the whole nation now, that they're castigated as racist and sexist and homophobic. And then they feel, as religious people, that it's a more secular culture, so they feel marginalized in that way. And then they see that actually, as whites, their days are numbered, so demographically marginalized. And so all of that together, with this sense that the government is on the side of the line cutters, makes them a sitting duck for Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm.
Who says, oh, I see your problem. You're going backwards. It's a problem. I single-handedly will lift you up in some secular rapture. So that's the deep story for the right. And I went back to my people that I really came to know, and one guy said, you read my mind. Another guy said, I live your metaphor. And a woman said, well, no, you forgot about taxes. People are waiting in line or paying for the people who are cutting in line.
Mm.
And so this isn't cheating. You were raising that issue. It's that it felt to them unfair. Not a self-conscious, gosh, I'm going to. He felt that the line cutters didn't feel they were cheating. They just had a different idea about what the
rules
were.
Right.
And so the point being for those on the progressive side, that in the minds, if you want to understand the minds of people that voted for Trump, inequality and unfairness are not the same thing. I think for a lot of people on the Democratic side, inequality itself seems unfair. Wait a minute, how did this happen? The top 1% own what 40% of American money. That seems unfair. But to the people I came to know on the right, that wasn't unfair particularly. But what was unfair was your chance for getting to the American dream and the idea of line cutters.
Yeah, and
so,
no, it's
the left has a different, a deep story, but that, I believe, just to communicate how they see, that's the point of this book, and to kind of point ways we can take it from there. But first we have to understand how they think.
Yeah. So if there was a brief answer to it, does my notion of pointing out the ways that those who buy the government and those who you know, cheat the process, that is not something that while that wasn't what you were saying cutting in line was, because it wasn't a conscious cheating, do you think that pointing out where the Republicans and the polluters are cheating is something
yes.
that people resonate? Yeah.
I think that's unifying.
Yeah.
I think they would nod their heads and
yeah.
they say, we don't think that's good. It's not in our interest. And so for a unifying new frontier, a kind of let's move forward
yeah.
narrative, I think stopping polluters from polluting could very well fit into that.
Mm-hmm.
They would go for that.
Yeah. One comment I just want to make is that a feeling I had during the campaign also was that when the Clinton campaign shifted, it seemed to me, towards the end, almost everything was anti-Trump, he's unfit, and so on. And my feeling at the time was that if I was one of your folks in Louisiana, and I felt that I had been ignored by all the powerful people, and my life had been made worse, and I'd been put down, as you say, the North wagging its finger at me, and suddenly there was this macho billionaire TV star who said, I'm with you, I get you, of course you're going to say he's unfit. Of course
right.
you're going to. So that rather than, you know, being a warning, it was actually a further bonding of, you know, I know why you're doing that. It's because he sticks up for me.
That's right. That's right. At the end of my book, I describe going to a primary rally in New Orleans and looking at all the Trump future Trump supporters. His primary, and he won overwhelmingly in Louisiana, the primary, and in the final election. But watching people's response to him, I had a feeling that I had been studying for 4.5 years the dry kindling, and now I saw the match.
Mm.
I saw how he made them feel recognized,
yep.
especially white blue-collar voters, recognized, and we seem to be offering solutions. And it's not that they loved him. No, they saw every kind of flaw, but they forgave those flaws because he seemed to be speaking to them.
Yeah.
Can't ignore that.
Not at all.
You know, that's to start with. We have to look at that.
Let me share with you that when I'm not doing this, I work with organizations on communications. And in my presentations, I single out one particular slide and I say, this is the most important slide on which everything else depends. And it says simply, human beings want more than anything to feel seen and heard.
Right. That is true. I really feel that's true. And if there's a power to it, as well as a dignity. And it helps humanize the listener. It's not just that you're giving something to another person by truly crossing what I came to call the empathy wall.
Mm-hmm.
It's that they are giving something to you. You're deeper as a result. There's somehow a humanizing that goes both ways.
Oh, of course. In other
yeah.
words, if what humans crave is to be seen and heard, it only makes sense that seeing and hearing has to feel deeply ennobling and deeply gratifying. And
right.
I did read some of, you know,
and humbling
your
in
acknowledgments
a curious way.
When you say, mm-hmm. you know, they gave me a great deal. And someone says, wait a minute, you went, you listened, you represented them, but you said, yeah, but they gave me their time. They gave
yeah.
me their attention. They let me in.
And they let me in knowing who I was and knowing from the get-go that we weren't going to agree. on most things.
Right.
You know? And so that, hey, you know, I was coming from the outside, from another political bubble, Berkeley, California.
Yep.
And they, so it was extra generous on their part, you know?
Yeah. Yeah,
and
no, because
so
I really
appreciated that.
They saw your T-shirt. They knew where you were from.
That's right. That was the deal. Look, so, I was completely open with where I was coming from, and that was the marvelous part of it. So it was became a kind of a joint project. How can we find some common ground here? Or even if there isn't much common ground. How can we respect one another?
Yeah.
I mean, I think there is a pre-political first step that the whole country has to take to really establish a floor of respect and then create structures through which we come together and see if we can find strips of common ground. We're never going to turn into each other. There are basic differences, but we can find on a lot of issues strips of common ground. You and I have been covering some of them.
Yeah.
But I think also reducing prison populations. I've talked to a lot of Trump supporters in Louisiana and said, yeah, we need to get them back to work and back into their families. And these laws have been draconian. Come on, let's, for nonviolent criminals. So that is a really big, I think, a point of common ground. On renewable energy, there's actually a woman in Florida who has started the Tea Party, green tea. She's Tea Party, but
yep,
she's green.
We've got about one, maybe even less than a minute. If people want to join, learn more about what we're talking about, which is, you know, this new frontier, this new narrative, this new coming together that grows, that begins in a respect and a listening and a seeing, where would you tell them to go besides your book?
I would tell them to Google the Bridge Alliance, and which is an umbrella group covering some 70, now 80 different pop-up groups called like High from the Other Side and Living Room Conversations and Making American Dinner Again, where people from different sides get together with a commitment to explore a potential common ground.
So that is the Bridge Alliance. Is it .com, .org?
I think it's .com.
Okay. Either way.
There are two that'll come up, but yeah, check the one for members of a Bridge Alliance.
Okay.
Yeah.
Very good. Okay. The website to learn more about Arlie Hochschild's work would be to go to berkeley.edu and then search for Arlie Hochschild, and it's HOCHSCHILD. The book is Strangers in Their Own Land, Anger in Mourning on the American Right. Let me tell you one thing, Arlie. I had prepared, I will confess to how obsessive I am, about 12 pages of questions. And once I asked you basically the first question, which is, what's the new story? How do we do it? I almost had to throw out all of that. And what I can get is, you wrote this book over a five-year period. You've been talking about it for a year. When you had the chance to not have to cover the same ground, you leapt on it. And I really thank you for that.
Okay. Well, my great pleasure talking to you, Terrence.
Okay. So, for this conversation and many other interviews, articles, transcripts of interviews, to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. That's TerrenceMcnally.net or aworldthatjustmightwork, one word. They're the same website. If you want to receive a weekly email announcement, I'll tell you who we're going to be talking to, and I'll send you like 6, 7, 8 articles of relevance. You can sign up at my site, or you can email me at temcnally@mac.com. You can find years of podcasts at my site or at iTunes. Listen anytime, anywhere. Thanks to G, my engineer, Mark Maxwell, and D'Angelo Jones in production, and George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices. Most of all, to you, my listeners, please share this podcast widely. Thank you, Arlie Hochschild. Keep up the good work.
Well, same to you. Keep up your good work.
Okay.